Well, I'm glad to see that our biological sciences session is going to be so popular. My name is Pat Fitzgerald-Bocarsley, and I'll be the chair for the next two sessions. I'm a viral immunologist at Rutgers New Jersey Medical School, and I had the pleasure of reviewing all the biology abstracts. So that was really a lot of fun and a lot more diverse than the immunology that I'm used to looking at. So without further ado, we'll keep on time. Our first talk is by Roger Weens from Los Alamos, I believe, and he will be speaking on why should we expect to find life on Mars. And if you haven't heard Roger speak before, you're in for a real treat. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm a little bit intimidated. I hope you can hear me at the back if I speak loudly enough. Good. To be in a biology session because I was trained as a physicist and now I'm trying to do geology on Mars. I thought that for this, for the ASA, I'd like to say a little bit about what really is driving the research on Mars, which is the question of life. And, you know, it's a question that we are happy to be involved in because we know that God created life. We don't know where all he has created life, and that's an exciting thing for us because we can learn more about him through this creation and what we can learn from where life happens to be in the universe. And I'm going to try on this topic. I don't have, there's areas of this that I have a lot of knowledge in and some that I don't have much knowledge at all, so I hope you'll bear with me. So Mars happens to be in the habitable zone of the solar system. It's near the outside part, and because of that, for a long time, the predictions were that Mars should never have had stable water on its surface due to the thin atmosphere and the fact that it's farther from the sun. But we actually have, in the last number of years, really proven that to not be the case, that Mars really was habitable. And that's due to the fact that from orbit, we can see things like Mars River deltas. This is an Ebersole crater. And on the ground, we were able to see massive amounts of sediments in Gale Crater with the Curiosity rover, and not just sediments, but conglomerates. And these things are only produced in river systems, rounded pebbles, and then cemented together, and these conglomerates with little rounded pebbles falling right out of them. And so there was no question after this whatsoever that we had not just ephemeral water on the surface of Mars, but very long-lived lakes, rivers, and even oceans on Mars. So Mars is habitable. And so then the next question is, was it inhabited? And so that's what we're trying to go after. And just kind of to cut to the chase with the title of my talk, I'm going to answer it in this slide so you can go home after that. But one of the topics is the fact that we have meteorites on Earth that we know have come from Mars. We've got over 150 of them. They do look like terrestrial rocks, but there's several, at least three lines of evidence that they are from Mars, and so we really know that that's the case. And if we have meteorites that are coming from Mars in that abundance, then we can be pretty sure that over geologic history, we would have had meteorites from Earth blasted off of the Earth and finding their way to Mars. This is Meteor Crater in Arizona. This is unrelated, but if this is one of the Mars meteorites, it happens to be the one that I studied for my PhD thesis a little while back. So if that happened, then we would have possibly spread life to Mars because all the rocks on the Earth are containing bacteria. So even if you believe that God only created life on the Earth, you can believe that there could be life on Mars. All right, so then the question might be, have we already found life on Mars? And the answer is no. But there was this tantalizing bit of evidence in 1996. There were carbonate structures that were found inside of a Martian meteorite, and they looked like that. But they were too small, and I should have put the references in there. This is by a science paper by McKay et al, 1996. But these features were actually too small. They're even not only too small for terrestrial DNA, they're too small for terrestrial RNA. And so there is no one in the almost no one in the scientific community that really thinks this represents some life on Mars. But it was very provocative, And so people have started to question, what should we be looking for on Mars to really find life on Mars? And so this talk is going after that. Now we have, Mars is actually a great place to study early life, in a sense, if we actually were to find it there, because of the fact that relative to Earth, the weathering rates on Mars are extremely slow. And so you can go to Mars and it's like going back in time. And so this is a color-coded picture of the surface geoid of Mars. And you can see that these colors correspond to these timeline, this timeline down here. And so the whole southern hemisphere, almost all of that dates to longer ago than 3.6 billion years ago in what's called the Noachian era. Then we had a Hesperian, from which most of the northern hemisphere dates to, based on crater counts. And then we have more recent Amazonian times, especially up in the Tharsis region, where there's a lot of volcanism more recently. But if we were to map that onto what has happened on Earth, so first of all, this is the time when you have a lot of sediments, and so there is likely a lot of water on Mars, but by the time you were back to 3 billion years ago or more recent, we wouldn't have seen that much water activity on Mars. That's the current thinking. Now, if we map that onto Earth, so we know there's water on Earth by 4.2 billion years, but life has been confirmed on Earth by about 3.5 billion years, if you're able to trust the research interest from satellites and so on. But it could have been, as we may have evidence, as far back as 3.8 billion years. All right, so the life on Earth intersects with the time when Mars would have been habitable back in this period of time right here. So we're going to explore that just a little bit more. So this is the timeline for life on Earth. And so we have sort of the what I've talked about already, this part of the earliest evidence for life on Earth here. And then I pointed out that Mars is less habitable by 3 billion years ago. But in terms of abundance, most of the life on Earth relies on photosynthesis, oxygen-producing photosynthesis. And based on that, we have this what's called the Great Oxygenation Event that happened between 2 and 2.5 billion years ago. And so the stuff that started to produce that was around by about 2.5 billion years ago. But what happened before this? What was the precursor to cyanobacteria? And that's a really interesting question. We think that life on Earth was much, much less abundant before it was able to fix oxygen. And so you'd be probably related to life now found in hot springs or black smokers. This is life that can find its own energy sources and doesn't need the oxygen photosynthesis. And just to look at this in another light, this is a sort of the latest version, possibly somewhat controversial still, in terms of the tree of life. And the first oxygen photosynthetic organisms, here's cyanobacteria. Here, we're way off on this branch, way over here. And so if there's 2.3 million known species. So what would have been earlier would have been probably over on the left-hand side of this. And so there are a lot of species there, but the question is, which ones of those would have been around possibly that long ago and could have maybe been, have relatives on Mars, you could say. And so we have to look at the sort of this flow chart of microbial metabolism, and this talks to that a little bit as well. So you have things that are, photoautotrophs, which are getting their energy from light, and then you have these things down here, chemoautotrophs, that are not getting their energy from light. These are the things that are, eating the rocks and fixing things like manganese. So, these would have been related to cyanobacteria, the great oxygenation event, and the precursors would lie down here. And in fact, some research recently just suggests that the immediate precursor of cyanobacteria was, in fact, a manganese-fixing species. The cyanobacteria and its immediate relatives have this manganese-fixing vestigial appendages, so to speak, with manganese. And so that's pretty interesting to find out. The stuff down here is what we're talking about. Would it potentially have relatives on Mars, if you want to talk like that? Okay, now, part of the difficulty, we mentioned that Earth, by contrast to Mars, has so much more going on, weathering-wise and tectonics, and so it's hard to find the stuff that would have been around this long ago on Earth. But what do we find on Earth? We have stromatolites, and so these are these are the things that produce where microbial mats have left evidence of their existence in the rock record, and so you'll have alternating layers of carbonate and silicate material. Many times in the really ancient stuff, it's metamorphosed and didn't really maintain the organic structure. And so you can see stromatolites in things that are 3 point some billion years old, and this is one example here. Or Silurian, of course, is much, much, much more recent, of just several hundred million years ago. And there you have much more stuff that you can actually study, and it's much less likely to be metamorphosed. Okay, so let's talk about Mars. Do we see either structures or organics on Mars? And so that's what we're going to talk about for just a few minutes. Would we find stromatolites, for example? So first of all, how have we explored Mars? Starting in 1997, 20 years ago, there's been these three generations of Mars rovers. And so the latest one is Curiosity, and that's last year I got to give a full hour talk about my involvement with the ChemCam instrument that sits up here with the big red eye. So these are the things that have been exploring Mars, and these are the goals with this idea to assess Mars' biological potential at the top of this list. Okay, structures. We have not seen any bona fide stromatolites on Mars, unfortunately. And in fact, the lithic carbon is relatively low at the present and previous landing sites, and so it doesn't seem like we would see that kind of thing there. We have seen some interesting structures that we're not completely sure how to explain. I'm going to flash this picture to you just to show you some of these things I wrote a paper on. But we think they're related to redox reactions in the rocks. Anyway, some intriguing stuff there. In terms of organics, the SAM instrument, stands for Sample Analysis on Mars, has analyzed samples with a gas chromatograph, micro column that was built in France, along with mass spectrometers built in the US, and found some parts per billion or picomoles of chlorobenzene. And chlorobenzene is not a very favorite organic for those of us who are living organisms. Chlorobenzene was found in some of these drill holes and not in others. And so we can tell, I mean, these are effectively a blank test, and then we found some of that here. But this is not a whole lot of material, picomoles. And so and why is it chlorobenzene? And so we got those results at the beginning of the mission, started scratching our head over that, and then some things started to fall into place, we think. So here's an explanation. So we know that on Mars, perchlorates are present. These are superoxides, so they'll produce oxygen when you heat them up or give them water. And they're present not only in the soil, but in the sedimentary rocks. And so what happens is you get the sample into the SAM instrument, and you're heating this up to drive off the organics, right? Well, it drives off the oxygen too, and so you oxidize your organics, and there go your organics. So we have only that small amount of chlorobenzene and a few other things like it, but then we have the carbon that's evolved at these temperatures in the oven of that instrument, 150 to 400 degrees C, and they can be used to infer an upper limit for the organic abundances. So once you've gotten rid of the, say, adsorbed material, say, by 150 degrees C, then you should be evolving organic oxygen or CO2 from organics. So what do we find? We find up to 0.24 weight percent of potentially organic carbon or organic CO2. This is orders of magnitude higher than those picomoles and from the GC experiments. And so this seems like a potentially plausible explanation. Certainly for those optimists who would like to find organics on Mars, this sounds really good. This is actually comparable to seafloor sediment organic carbon abundances. And so that means that not only are we on the lithotrophic side, but we could be on the heterotrophic side. That is, we could have organics possibly that would even not even be fixing carbon, but would be on the right hand side of that flowchart that I showed a couple of minutes ago. They could be using organics that's recycled. But remember that this, you know, this is a possibility, but the source of organic carbon could actually be from space, because meteorites actually have organics and they actually have amino acids in them. And those meteorites rain down on the Earth, they rain down on Mars, and so this organic carbon could actually just be from meteorites and dust. So that's still a possibility as well. And so we really need to understand what is it we're seeing with these experiments better. So that brings us to the next Mars mission. And so we're fortunately, the interest worldwide in Mars missions is actually picking up. And so NASA's planning this rover, the Europeans are planning this rover, and our Chinese friends are proposing this rover. And just by the way, I noticed that there's this nice little laser beam in the Chinese picture. So I think they like what we did with ChemCam. And so we'll see what happens with that. But that's a side subject. This is actually from Nature Journal, and it just shows all the different components of the Mars 2020 NASA rover. So just to point out, there's two instruments that can potentially look at organics on Mars with this rover. Sherlock is a UV Raman and fluorescence instrument on the arm of the rover, and we have a small part in that instrument at Los Alamos. And then SuperCam is the instrument that I'll be leading in the next Mars rover as well. We're doing this as a remote sensing, but we are using remote Raman spectroscopy and infrared, so if there's a lot of organics, we would be able to see that too. But by far the much better detection limit would be within Sherlock. So there's a future to looking at and exploring this. Beyond that, this rover is designed to collect and return, sorry, I only said the first part of that, designed to collect samples on Mars using hollow drill cores or hollow drills that will bring up cores out of these rocks, and it will deposit the samples on the ground for a future mission to bring these back to Earth. And so that's also a real bona fide way to continue studying these kinds of samples in a very very extensive way. And so we're hoping that sometime in the 2020s there will be this little rocket that will launch off of Mars with those samples and get those back to Earth, possibly as a precursor to human exploration of Mars. But anyway, that would be a great way to study organics if we don't see or don't have enough tools on the surface of Mars already. So that's where we're at. NASA is also looking for potential of looking for life in other places in the solar system. And so there is a Europa orbiter. Europa is one of these moons of Jupiter that has an icy surface, but is thought to have an ocean core, ocean mantle, I should say, or below the ice anyway. And so they're also hoping to launch a lander in the 2020s. We'll see how that goes, but it should be sometime in the future. We also just heard that there is actually organics on the surface of Ceres, which is an asteroid that is far enough out that it's ice-covered as well and has some organics on it. So there are other places to look at organics in the solar system as well. And so conclusions, musings, and implications. So life is incredibly complex. It took a long time to develop on Earth. First of all, oxygen photosynthesis took at least a billion years from the time of first life to the time of cyanobacteria, and then multicellular life took a lot longer. I'm just going to say Christianity does not teach that life is unique on Earth. It's kind of like Christianity didn't ever tell the Europeans in the Middle Ages that there were two continents that they never knew about, being North and South America. And yet those were discovered, and there's many other things that are not in the Bible that we now know about. Whether you life is unique on earth does not necessarily point to Christianity. We don't have to, as Christians, say, well, we've got to be unique because God has a relationship with us. So I see persuasive but passive evidence for an intelligent God in the universe. But there's no limitations for how, where, or when he created and developed life based on what I read in the Bible. And so then we can ask, is this a theological issue? I would say no in terms of apologetic, in other words, how God did it. But I would say yes in terms of the beauty, yes in terms of understanding God through creation, certainly yes in terms of the fact that we know about the anthropic principle and that God has created us and that we are here. Thank you.
Thank you for a very provocative talk. So if you could repeat the question that's being recorded.
Sure.
So that we can get the questions.
Roger, what's the possibility of, on a future mission, flying a stable isotope mass spec to look at Delta 13, carbon 12 versus carbon 13, to get some hint as to where the carbon is from?
Okay, so just to repeat the question, it was about what is the possibility of flying a stable isotope mass spectrometer that will look at the ratio of carbon isotopes. That is actually part of the SAM instrument, but it's these amounts, I believe, are too small for that to be studied with the isotope mass spectrometer. I could potentially be wrong on that, so I should check. But the CO2 that was evolved is certainly being studied as for its isotope ratios. I'm sorry, I'm not quite up on the results from that. Yes.
Getting back to the Goldilocks zone, I understand that in the time we're talking about, the sun was much less bright than it turned out to be now. And would that impact whether Mars was in the Goldilocks zone?
Yeah. Okay, so I'll repeat that as well. So that's a great question. It was about the habitability zone of our solar system and the fact that the early sun is thought to have been only 70% as luminous as a current present-day solar luminosity. And that's basically, supposedly, basic physics or astrophysics based on the main sequence of stellar evolution. And how did that affect the climate on Mars at that time, which is when we're looking for some of this way back in time. And that's a major problem, actually. And so that's why it's called the faint young sun paradox. And the issue to me is that the early Earth seems to want a more luminous sun as well. I would love to get some astrophysicists in the room and talk about how we could get a warmer, very young sun to help both of these planets. And so that's something that I'd love to discuss.
Could the Earth have more geologic activity at that time that might have made it warmer?
So the question is whether Earth had more geologic activity. It certainly had more, the radioactive heating was more in all of the planets at that time. But even when that's taken into account, it would be nice to have a warmer Earth based on the solar, to have higher solar luminosity. So I don't know how that paradox will be solved. We'll see. Yes?
Stephen Hawking has speculated that Earth will become uninhabitable in a century or even younger. And he indicates colonizing Mars as a result. How realistic is that? Because it seems to me that we already have a habitable planet if we can keep it habitable. Isn't it going to be extremely difficult to make a currently uninhabitable planet habitable?
Okay, I'll try to repeat that one as well. So the question was, the statement first was that Stephen Hawking has stated, and correctly so, in my opinion, that in several billion years, the Earth will be less habitable because of the increasing luminosity of the sun. And, should we work to colonize Mars so that we have a cooler, more clement place during those next several billion years from now? And I would have to say I'm not looking quite that far into the future. Kathy Hayhoe, I think I certainly subscribe to looking as far as she is into the future, but I don't think we have to look that far ahead. But having said that, I would love to see Mars colonized. So whatever you want to take of that.
Yeah, there's a question back here.
I believe you said in one of your earliest slides that in some of these meteorites there were structures that were probably or quite likely bacteria. But then you went on to indicate that the original Allen Hills meteorite that had given rise to some of these suggestions that the structures were not bacteria. What evidence does one say that these probably are bacteria?
Oh, okay. Let me try to repeat that question. It was about findings of meteorites some years back suggesting that there were bacteria in the meteorites. I don't know of any results that suggest that there were or are any bacteria in meteorites that are exogenic. In other words, we can have weathering and contamination of meteorites if they've been sitting on the ground for some time. And one has to be sure that you're distinguishing that from something that would have come from outer space. And so we don't know of any bacteria that's come from space and been found in meteorites. The pictures that I showed were some carbon structures, but we don't know what how they're formed, but it doesn't seem like they were formed from any life form because they're too small for RNA.
Okay, just your statement.
No, I'm not advocating that there was extraterrestrial bacteria in any meteorite.
Okay, we have time for two quick questions, so go ahead.
To what extent would you say initial colonization or this visitation of Mars by people is in conflict with searching for life on Mars? Are we going to contaminate the place?
To what extent is sending people to Mars in conflict with looking for life on Mars? I think it probably is. NASA has a planetary protection office that is charged with keeping other places clean and keeping us uncontaminated from extraterrestrial viruses. And so we do a lot to try to keep these spacecraft clean that are going to Mars. But once humans get there, all bets are off. We're gonna poop on the planet. And once that happens, then there's gonna be bacteria all over. So that's all I can say about that.
Okay, Josh, last question.
Just out of curiosity, people thought about, because I mean, there's obviously this exchange of material between Mars and Earth. I mean, it could have gone the other way. I mean, life could have started there and then come here. People like thought about that or did it relative probability?
Yes, so I'll repeat that as well. It was a suggestion that potentially life could have started on Mars and then moved to Earth. And there are actually people that are advocating that. And so, it's a possibility. We don't know how that... We have so few clues about the earliest life. And so, yeah.
Great. Thank you very much for a very provocative...